Josiah Henson was the little-known man behind one of the most notorious characters in history, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom.
Uncle Tom's Cabin was a massive global success. It sold over 1 million copies in its first year in print and became the best-selling novel of the century.
It was used to put a face to slavery.
And it really opened people's eyes to the plight of these blacks, being seen as property, being treated as animals.
It not only balloons up in sales, but there's also a negative reaction to it.
And then the controversy begins, where people are criticizing the book, saying, how can this be? Blacks being whipped and beaten and tortured, it just can't be.
Harriet Beecher Stowe pushed back by publishing a giant book of all her sources called The Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin.
On page 26 and 27, she talks about Josiah Henson. Henson's life story was integral to Uncle Tom's Cabin.
After more than a century of racism and tens of millions of copies in print, everyone has heard of Uncle Tom. But how have we never heard of Josiah Henson? How has history forgotten this man?
From that time to the present, I have been called Uncle Tom, and I feel proud of the title. If my humble words in any way inspired that gifted lady to write, I have not lived in vain, for I believe her book was the beginning of the glorious end.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Novelists write millions of words and create hundreds of thousands of characters every year. Occasionally, a single book and a specific character capture the moment and change the way readers see themselves and their society. That was certainly the case with the publication of Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin in 1852. The title character was inspired by a real person, Josiah Henson. Distinguishing the flesh and blood Josiah Henson from the Stowe's Uncle Tom and the racially charged and twisted Uncle Toms created by minstrel shows and melodramas is the task that Jarrett Brock took on in his book, The Road to Dawn, and an accompanying documentary film entitled Josiah, which will be screened and discussed tonight beginning at 6 p.m. at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. We are joined today by author and producer Jarrett Brock, and by the manager of program initiatives for the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center, Chris Miller. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Jarrett, welcome to Cincinnati Edition and also to Cincinnati. I know you just drove in from Chicago, right?
Yes, got up at 4 this morning.
Very good. I'm glad to have you here. Chris, welcome back.
Thank you, Dan.
We'll get you an endowed chair here soon. So anyway, let's begin, Jarrett, with the historic person of Josiah Henson. You spent years with this man. What makes him as a person stand out apart from the Uncle Tom's Cabin, Harriet Beecher Stowe connection, but just on his own? How would you describe him briefly?
Oh, man, I think his story is more interesting than Uncle Tom's story, frankly. This is a man who spends the first 40 years of his life in slavery. He has both his shoulders shattered by an overseer. He can never raise his hands above his head. He gets to Canada with his wife and 4 children, and he decides he can't live a comfortable life. And so he keeps going back. He rescues 118 people, starts a business, and wins a medal at the first World's Fair. He's entertained at Windsor Castle and the White House. He builds a freeman settlement that grows to 500 people. And of course, he's the inspiration for Uncle Tom's Cabin. This is a huge historical character with an amazing story, and yet somehow it disappeared from the history books.
He's also a very complicated character. I mean, both as a person who was enslaved, he became somebody who was counted on by his masters to be the overseers on the plantation. He was somebody who was trusted. He was also a minister. He found Christianity. He became a minister at a time when being a Christian minister among slaves was a very complicated task, because what you could say and what you couldn't and how you interpreted certain passages really was complicated. And he's somebody who gets really caught in that. And in fact, you talk about him as, at one point, you say, well, if this was a modern analysis, we might say he had Stockholm syndrome. And, or another place you said, utterly brainwashed by illiteracy and indoctrination. So there's a real complication here. This isn't necessarily just a simple story.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Josiah tries to learn to read when he's a boy, and there's another slave who tries to teach him, and they get caught, and Josiah takes a huge beating for it, and the other enslaved boy gets sold south. So Josiah doesn't learn to read until he's in his 40s. So everything he knows about faith and religion, he learns from whites and what little his fellow enslaved people know. And so he really relies on his memory and his sense of humor to get him through. But he has like this good guiding light, this moral compass. His desire is for freedom, and he thinks the only honorable way to get that is by purchasing his freedom. So he actually uses preaching as a good way to fundraise to try and win himself his freedom.
Or earn himself his freedom and raise the actual money. Chris, there's a – Cincinnati isn't the center of this story, but it plays into this story at a number of points, and it really illustrates the way Cincinnati was part of a larger environment of that early first part of the 19th century, with when the issue is increasingly what was America going to do about slavery and what did the enslaved people decide to do for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Where the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center is located is in the heart of what was once called Little Africa, a black settlement in Cincinnati. And in Josiah's testimony in the book that he wrote, he talks about where he is guiding 18 other enslaved individuals to his slaveholder, from his slaveholder's house to the brother of his slaveholder's house. And he comes to the banks close to the Cincinnati, right where we're located at, and he's encouraged to continue going north in order to have freedom. But like Jared said, his only thought was the only way I can obtain freedom was to actually purchase it, because slavery is law. If I'm stealing myself, I am breaking the law. And so he wanted to abide by that, and he guided himself, his family, and those others to that the brother's location, which he ended up regretting later. But I think it speaks to his character. He was loyal, probably loyalty to a fault per se, but he carried that with him as after he obtained his freedom. So Cincinnati does play a very significant role, not only in this story, but just in the story of the Underground Railroad. And that's why we are located where we're located at.
Yeah, and when he does finally decide to take his family and escape from Kentucky, from enslavement, he works his way not straight to Canada through Indiana, but he brings himself back to – he and his family back to Cincinnati and then up north through Ohio, which is kind of interesting that he – Cincinnati sort of is this pivot point for him.
Yeah, it really is. And also he has a Methodist minister friend who helps him fundraise, and they do a bunch of preaching in Cincinnati. The abolitionists in this city have for – in Josiah's story in particular, I don't know if he could have done it without them. They are the ones who provision him to make his way through the woods of northern Ohio to get to Sandusky to then head to freedom.
Chris, one of he writes a story about his experience, which collectively this is part of the larger slave narratives. A lot of people who had been enslaved, once they gained their freedom, wrote their own life histories. And in that story, the story of the Underground Railroad, that's where we find a lot of the evidence of this. And there's some real themes there that who helps along the way. And Jarrett was making some reference, but what else comes out in that story?
A lot. I look at the chapters, the earlier chapters where he talks about his boyhood. I think it cannot be lost upon us that he saw his father lashed 100 times against his bare back. His ear was nailed to the whipping post and severed from his body. And he witnessed that. And that was the punishment for beating up or the overseer who was attempting to rape his wife. And so I think you see this conditioning of slavery and that the impression that it leaves upon a young man. And then also, too, he goes on to speak about how he was physically gifted, how he talked about how fast he could run, how he could wrestle. And he took great vanity in knowing of his physical prowess. And I think that's fascinating, especially when you talk about males today, more specifically young Black males, and finding vanity in what they physically can do and not thinking about the mentality, what you can do as far as with your mind and with your spirituality, which he relied upon in his later years. So I think it's a very relevant piece then and now.
So how did Harriet Beecher Stowe know anything about Josiah Henson?
Mm-hmm. So the best we can put it together, there comes a point on one of Josiah's travels to New England that he's in Boston, and he ends up meeting up with a former mayor of Boston who later becomes a congressman and then a senator. And Josiah is illiterate, so he dictates the story to this mayor. The mayor writes it down and reads it back to him. And they publish it as this, you know, it's a paperback pamphlet. It's very cheap. You know, I've seen it. And it circulates around the abolitionist community in the North. And there's a copy of it in the Boston abolitionist reading rooms. And we're quite certain that that's where Harriet Beecher Stowe first sees it. Josiah then writes in a later version of his memoir that he met up with her in Andover, Massachusetts, just as she's really thinking about, I need to write a rip-roaring novel because I got to do something about the Compromise of 1850. So,
which included the Fugitive Slave Act, a new Fugitive Slave Act, which just shocked many, many Northerners.
It infuriated Harriet Beecher Stowe. Basically, the government said that every American is a potential criminal. If you aid and abet, if you help, if you feed, if you clothe, if you withhold information that could lead to an
if
enslaved person.
If you don't
person,
actively help recapture.
Yeah, you could get a fine of the modern equivalent of up to $250,000. And Stowe was like, this is the wrong direction for our country to go. So she sat down and she told her sister, I will write this thing if I live.
So what's the relationship of Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom and Josiah Henson?
So there's a couple of different things. She mentions – she writes a second book called The Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin, where she names all her sources. And she mentions them eight times.
Which she does that because she's challenged.
Yes.
Southerners want to deny that what she described in Uncle Tom's Cabin couldn't possibly be true.
Yes.
And she went back at him.
Well, it's interesting. Not only do they crush her in the media, but they also write anti-Tom novels with titles like Aunt Phyllis's Cabin, the South as it truly is. And so she decides to fight fake news with facts, and so she publishes a giant bibliography. She mentions Josiah eight times in that, and she specifically mentions a scene where he raises an axe. He has the opportunity to kill his master's son and escape to freedom, and he doesn't take that opportunity. So she really is kind of akinning him with this Uncle Tom slash Christ figure, this man who's willing to literally lay down his life if necessary, that he's willing to sacrifice himself, total, you know, pacifist, peaceful, there's a bigger game at play for Josiah Henson and for Uncle Tom. And so it's really about freedom. And so that's kind of her main connection.
And that incident takes place in New Orleans.
Yes.
Because he's been literally shipped down south and he's going to be sold.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the temptation on the one hand. He knows what's coming and he's tempted to kill his master's son and decides not to.
I honestly don't know, Dan, what I would do in that position. Like, he's raised a huge down payment, so over 75%, to buy his freedom. He's got a promissory note for the rest. They add a zero. He's never going to be able to get his freedom. And when,
rather than owing 100, he now owes 1,000.
1,000, yeah, which is a huge amount in modern dollars. And when they realize he's not going to be able to pay anymore, they just decide, well, let's get every last cent out of him. And so they sell him south. And Providence intervenes, but yeah, I can't imagine being put in that situation.
Chris, what's the role of Uncle Tom's Cabin? What did it do in society? It comes out in 1852. The Key gets published a year later in 1853. This is after the Fugitive Slave Act. It's 7-8 years prior to the outbreak of the Civil War, although nobody knows that's going to happen yet. What is the power of Uncle Tom's Cabin?
Well, First, let me set some context, especially when it relates to the state of Ohio. In the state of Ohio, we had black laws, black codes, and much of that addressed fugitive slave. It was a Fugitive Slave Act in itself that was in place until 1849. And so even assisting fugitive slaves, those seeking freedom at that time, you could be fined or arrested in some regard. So that was in place as well. But also in 1850, you have this debate, and this is where it leads into that impact, of exactly how bad is slavery? Is it really that bad? And we see that conversation come up today. And so what it did was it pulled back the sheet on what exactly slavery was and how people were being treated. And some people couldn't fathom that men, women, and children were treated in such a way. And so what it did was it did garner all this support and like, oh, this must come, this must be abolished. And so it was very critical in how in the institution, when we lead into our Civil War gallery space, we cite three different stories, one being Uncle Tom's Cabin, the other being John Brown, the raiding of Harper's Ferry. And then the third is just the role of Frederick Douglass. And so those incidents leading up to the Civil War. And so the novel was very, very, or I should say the story of Uncle Tom's Cabin was very significant in advancing the country towards abolishing slavery. But it took a war to do that.
Yeah, Jared, I think you used the term at one point in your book. You say it personalized things for people in a way. It was fiction. It was a novel. There were abolitionists out there writing about the evils of slavery, and they influenced a lot of people. But this, how many copies get out? What kind of reaction is there to this?
It was massive. You know, 300,000 copies its first year alone, 1 million copies in the UK. The joke was that everyone was reading it publicly in the North and privately in the South. It was banned in tons of Southern counties, and they had 17 printing presses running around the clock to try and keep up with the desperate demand for this book. And there's actually, I found a really funny letter of a minister writing to Frederick Douglass, and he says, well, now we know our old friend Henson is the real Uncle Tom. Maybe Stowe's publisher will cough up some cash for his life story. But of course, that never happens. Yeah, the impact was massive. You know, this is number one selling book of the century, aside from the Bible. It's huge.
So how does, I mean, if you read Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is Uncle Tom being inspired by, but the story of Josiah Henson isn't the story of Uncle Tom. There's just elements and they're used, drawn from there. But how does Uncle Tom of the novel become Uncle Tom that is a derogatory term?
So this is hugely credited to the racist blackface plays that were put on by racist whites. They ran for decades. They even ran in Josiah's hometown after he died. Like this, basically, there was no strong copyright law in America at the time, and so they just degraded this great character. Uncle Tom was supposed to mean Superman. It was supposed to mean King of Wakanda. It was supposed to be this really positive thing. My hope is that through this project, we can help to start redeem that term. None of us have seen a racist blackface play. So let's teach our boys, let's grow up our sons that they want to be an Uncle Tom, someone who is just courageous and self-sacrificing and just cares about others so much. So yeah, it was just these horrible, degraded plays that just turned him into this kowtowing to the white man, betrayer of his own race kind of guy.
The other part of this is that there is a certain extent that with the slave narratives, you learn a lot about slavery and you learn about the escape and you don't learn anything about what happens to people. Your book particularly, and my understanding is the movie sort of cuts off before you do all of this. But in the book, you really talk about Josiah Henson as a free man in Canada who has an amazing life that takes him to England several times. He meets the leading lights of the day. Talk a little bit about that.
So I live less than 2 hours from where Josiah spent the last 50 years of his life. And so it was just kind of astounding to me that I knew none of this story. So I retraced his journey 3,000 miles from slavery to freedom, went to three countries. I've been to all the plantations associated with his life, including the Kentucky one that he escapes from, which is still owned by the slave owner's descendants to this very day. So I got to...
What did they say when you got there?
Well, so they hadn't allowed anyone on the property in 40 years, and they gave me 2 hours. So I just took it and was very grateful for their generosity. But Josiah, yeah, a big part of Josiah's life is fundraising. There is tens of thousands of fugitives pouring north, and there is never enough provision for the vision. So he spends a lot of his life just raising money to build churches and support families.
Well, there's a lot more here, and I encourage people to go to the Freedom Center tonight at 6 o'clock, view the film, and also join the discussion. Thank you, Jared Brock and Chris Miller, for being with us today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. Selena Reeder is our assistant producer. Layla Shakuhi is our intern. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. And I am Dan Hurley.